Are you still there? Are you here? Have you fallen off the fiscal cliff? America sort of did, but what is it really all about? We're going to be talking about that with Michael Hudson, a research professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, research associate at the Levi Economics Institute at Bard College. His latest book is The Bubble and Beyond. He's one of the most brilliant economists I know. He also participated with me in the film In Debt We Trust. And this one, Michael, which I hope you'll remember, we're going to play a little song before we get going. Plunder.
Your Honor, for many years, I operated a Ponzi scheme through the investment advisory side of my business. I knew what I was doing was wrong, indeed criminal.
The shine on America's shoes got gold.
When Wall Street stepped into the fold,
Congress paid off, workers laid off.
Stanford, AIG, and Madoff.
Swaps, credit stops, empty wallets and empty shops,
and bank walking to AAA. Grandpa knows his 401k.
Plunder, Michael. That's where we still are all these years later, and it seems to be getting worse. So glad you could join me today as we try to puzzle over this incredible psychodrama we've just been through, the so-called fiscal cliff. You've been writing about it brilliantly and analyzing, you know, the underlying dynamics. But how do you feel about watching this fraud charade play out in front of your eyes?
Well, I used to watch the World Wrestling Foundation matches, and I thought they were hilarious. They were entertaining. It was all drama. And this was orchestrated in advance, just like a World Wrestling Foundation match, to make it appear as if there was really an urgency in order to lower living standards, to lower wages, to shift the taxes onto labor by raising the FICA withholding $100 a month from their paychecks, and by giving more money to Wall Street by really putting the class war back in business, as if somehow this was a fact of nature, as if somehow Obama were helping the economy by really screwing labor, which is what he's set out to do.
Well, you know, it's actually quite amazing because the media, you know, story here is the rich will pay more taxes, big victory for the Democrats. The Republicans were recalcitrant. You know, they wanted to wreck the economy, but we Democrats managed to put together the coalition that won the Senate and won the
House.
Wait
a minute, Danny. What paper you been reading? I've been reading the Wall Street Journal.
Okay.
And they say that Obama gave the Republicans much more than they were asking for. The Republicans were not asking for an increase in the set-aside for Social Security. Obama said, no, I want to cut Social Security. The Republicans said, we'll never get voted elected if we do that. Obama said, I don't care. I'm going to go down in history as the man who destroyed Roosevelt's Social Security. I'm the guy who, not Bush, not the Republicans, but I'm the guy who's going to wreck America's social program and undo the Grand Society and put the class war back in business. So he wants to go down in history as the most right-wing Republican president that he's done, ironically, by running as a Democrat.
You know, it's really pretty amazing because when you speak to people who, you know, basically are Obama supporters, you know, they see his role here as being Mr. Reasonable, Mr. Moderate, Mr. Let's find a point in the middle.
Here is a man who is filled with hatred. What everybody I know who knows him is that he is viciously attacks people who don't like him. The fact that he's done the drone campaign, the fact that he says if they don't do what I want, kill them. This is a personality trait that is very more like Dick Cheney's than anyone else's.
You know,
but you're right about what the left-wing press does. It's amazing that they don't treat the wage withholding as a tax. And of course it's a tax. They pretend that it's labor savings, but it's labor savings that Obama intends to do what Bush couldn't do, which is to turn it to privatize Social Security and turn all this over to Wall Street like Pinochet's boys did in Chile.
You know, what's also startling here, just on the level of basic public comprehension of what this was about. You know, I read one business publication basically said, don't worry about any of this because what we're talking about soars so far over most people's heads that they don't know whether, you know, to be for it or against it or really can't comprehend it.
I think that's right.
So it's structured in a way, in a way to tune us out and to allow the elite, the people at the top of the pyramid, to make the decisions. And, you know, in this world, there's only issues. There's no interests. You know, we don't really understand how what foreign banks were saying about this. We don't really understand the various forces that were involved in all this. And the part of the whole, I mean, I was reading Naked Capitalism, this great website that carried your articles, but there was also a piece on it about how various, you know, big banks, NASCAR even, you know, and other people, Goldman Sachs et al., made off like bandits in this whole thing. They were given certain deals that were never reported on, as far as I could see, anywhere.
That's right. And the Fed tried to keep them secret, and Congress had to demand that they be shown. And when they were shown, the press didn't seem to want to report very much on it.
So, I mean, isn't this part of the era, you know, kind of the age of missing information, if you will, for those of us who are trying to follow all these events and get beyond the message points? You know, it's very difficult to do because the media basically is like a bunch of blackbirds. You know, one lands, then they all land. One leaves, then they all leave. And, you know, so it suddenly it becomes a great victory. You know, middle of the night, the Senate has decided to do X, or the next day the House, and here's President Obama out in Ohio with out in Oahu, you know, Hawaii, you know, with an automatic, you know, pen, almost like those robo signing devices that were used in the foreclosure crisis, signing this bill. While on vacation, while on the beach, probably. And nobody sort of gets what's going on. This is what's so frightening to me. I mean, I thought you had a really valuable explanation about how what's happening. This battle is really about how debt and how, in a sense, finance, the whole finance world has taken over the economy. And why don't you explain that a little bit for folks? Because I found it very, very, I put it in my blog, I found it a very coherent explanation of what's really going on here on a deeper level.
Well, I'm not sure where to begin in describing debt, except to say when the government has been giving all this money to the banks, and we're talking about $13 trillion given to Wall Street, just created on computer money, why couldn't they create the same money to fund the public sector? Why can they create money to give to Wall Street and not to fund unemployment, not to fund social spending, not to fund Social Security? Social Security shouldn't really be a program that requires user fees at all. Certainly, Wall Street doesn't pay a user fee for all of its $13 trillion bailout or for its chunk loans. Only the working class is asked to pay a user fee. The rest of the economy, Wall Street, gets paid from these user fees, being turned over to them. And what it does, the banking sector's product is debt. And it, people think that debt is good because debt is what bids up housing prices. And they actually think that they're richer if their house is going up in price. But what this does is require new borrowers to go into a whole lifetime of debt just to get the mortgage out to buy the house. So the result is that in the United States, workers have to pay about 40% of their income just for housing, and the housing is inflated by mortgage debt. A house is worth whatever a bank will lend against it, and as banks lend more, it makes people borrow more. And if people are asking, why can't American workers compete with those of China or Indonesia? Because in China and Indonesia and India, they don't have to pay go into debt to pay rent like they do here.
Also governments, you know, accumulate all of this debt, too. So now governments, a lot of what we talk about here is, quote, the deficit is really debt payments that go back to bankers and go back to the people who loan the money.
That's right. It becomes self-fulfilling. And, you know, these people talk about Adam Smith and free markets, but Adam Smith wrote that no government has ever repaid its debt, although some pretend to.
You know, on top of all of this, you know, we're reading other reports sort of in the back pages, you know, Philadelphia to close 37 public schools, okay, you know, because they're just too expensive. They're talking about selling off the school system, the public school system in a good part of Philadelphia. My own high school in the Bronx, New York, DeWitt Clinton High, DeWitt C-L-I-N-T-O-N, boom, you know, one of the great high schools for 100 years in our city and in our country, is being threatened with closure now as part of this sort of austerity project, which doesn't use that word, you know. It's all put in terms of modernization and innovation.
It's actually much worse than you say. Look at Chicago. If you want to understand what Obama's plans are, he wants to cut education spending by about 90%, essentially get rid of public education. And you can look at this by looking at what his former chief of staff, Emmanuel Rahm, is doing in Chicago. He says each school district has to pay for its own schools. So in the black neighborhoods of Chicago, in the low-income neighborhoods, obviously they're not going to be able to pay for schools at all unless they get rid of unionized labor. So Rahm has said, look, I'm representing what the president wants. I hate labor unions. And the first thing he did was to break the labor union at Chicago's airports by moving to minimum wage labor at the airports. And now he says, we cannot afford to have schools that are where there's a teachers union. We have to shift to unionized labor, and this means untrained labor. So essentially, who's going to be teaching in the schools of the low-income neighborhoods? Not trained teachers, not unionized teachers. And essentially, the intention of Rahm and Obama is to create a whole underclass. And the amazing thing is that it's the blacks and the minorities that believe that because Obama is one of them, he wants to help them instead of doing everything he can to hurt them, to turn them over to his campaign contributors who do not have their welfare at heart.
So this is one of the great deceptions probably of all time, you know, in many ways. People voting against their self-interest but clouding their judgment because of racial affinities or social affinities and the like, long-time loyalty to the Democratic Party, which is, you know, as much of a corporate party as the Republican Party is. So, you know, we have a situation where not only is our media not reporting or omitting or forgetting a lot of what is being covered here, but on top of all of that, we have a situation where the public and the resistance to all of this is extremely weak, with many Democrats cheering Obama on because he's, quote, beating Republicans. And you know, so we're in this sort of polarized partisan war game, if you will. But the meaning of it is really not well understood by the public at large.
I think that's correct. They're looking at the words, not at the actions.
And, you know, and as you write about all of this and you go deeper, and your colleague Bill Black at the in Missouri at the University of Kansas City there talk about the role of financial fraud and crime and all the rest of it. And, you know, these words seem to kind of just slide off the Obama administration. They pay a little lip service. They're going to prosecute possibly two people involved in the LIBOR multi-trillion dollar scam. But we've seen no enforcement of laws when it comes to the roles of the role of the bankers and the role of the people who have transferred wealth from the greedy, from the needy to the greedy, to the poorest, from the poorest to the richest people in America.
Yeah, that's right. Mr. Obama is more Mr. Teflon than Ronald Reagan was. And the reason is that there's a kind of cognitive dissonance on the part of the public. Even in Kansas City, when Bill Black came to the faculty, everybody thought, wait a minute, the whole financial sector can't really be run by criminals. But he convinced us. And now all of us believe that indeed the banks have really been taken over by a kind of mafia. And these guys are just plain crooks. And the crooks have driven the rest. They're crooks like Keating and the SNL scandal people. And essentially, they are the people who wrote the liar's loans were the bankers, not the borrowers who were taking them out. And it's hard for people to imagine that banks, who they used to look up to, are actually taken over by the mafia, and that the mafia, they've made so much money by banking that they've been able to back the political campaigns of politicians who support what they're doing.
You know, you and I worked together, in the movie In Debt We Trust, the movie Plunder, trying to bring these issues out to the public at large. And we came up against an incredible roadblock. First of all, we had the money barely to make the movies, but not to really market them or get access, hard to get them on television in this country. Other countries were very open-minded about it. They were fascinated by it. They wanted to show these films and what have you. But in our country, we ran up against a kind of a block where anything approaching truth seems to be relegated, you know, to the trash can. I mean, we just saw just today an announcement. Al Jazeera is going to buy Current TV, which was a failing enterprise that Al Gore and some other investors put money into, but were very unsuccessful with, partly because they didn't know how to make a television station operate and what have you. So Al Jazeera has stepped in, and they have bought Current TV. Before the deal was even done, before Al Jazeera's plans for an American-based channel were even formulated and announced, Time Warner Cable here in New York City announced, we are not going to carry this. We are not running it. They don't even know what it is, but they are not going to run it. And, of course, they're not doing this for political reasons, I'm sure. It's because somebody somewhere didn't fill out the right form or you know.
No, they said there were too few people watching it, which, of course, is true. But the problem is that this doesn't enable Al Jazeera now to get anyone to watch it. So it's bought a company that all of a sudden has no assets. And the asset was the spectrum, the position on the broadcasting spectrum.
So here, you know, but the irony is, of course, you know, it's all sort of bizarre, okay? I don't know how else to put it. First of all, Al Jazeera is actually on the air, Time Warner Cable, right now, because they're subletting, you know, some space on another network that wasn't effective, RNN, an upstate news broadcaster. So they basically sold a license to Al Jazeera to use their cable position. No, you know, Al Jazeera did so. Time Warner said nothing about it. Time Warner has Russia Today on the spectrum on Time Warner Cable. It has CCTV, the official Chinese network. It has Greek, you know, kind of conservative Greek channel on there. It has foreign-owned channels. But when it comes to Al Jazeera really poised to become competitive in the news business, to really challenge the American networks and demonstrate that there is interest in and a market for news about the world, which has been, in a sense, relegated to the 10-minute, 10-second blips of the top stories, you know, of the week. Suddenly, Time Warner, without a moment's reflection, announces, we are not going to put this on the air.
I wonder, well, you'd think that that would lead Al Jazeera to then cancel the deal, saying, wait a minute, this is a material change in the deal, and we don't have
access. Time Warner, fortunately, isn't the only cable operator. Other operators
No, it isn't the only cable operator here in Queens. I'm in Forest Hills, and I don't have an option. Everybody here would like an option.
Just a little bit of history here. You might not remember this, but Time Warner wouldn't allow Fox News on the channel, okay? Mm-hmm. When Fox News was unveiled as a channel, there was a dispute going on between Time Warner and Fox, and particularly Time Warner was trying to be protective of CNN, which is their news channel, mm-hmm. okay? And they refused to allow Fox News on the air. Fox News now supposedly the top cable news outlet. But that changed quickly when Rupert Murdoch was willing to pay the price that Time Warner demanded, which was, I think, $25 per cable subscriber. Mm-hmm. It was pure extortion, a holdup. Murdoch had deep pockets, and he went for it, and he got it on the air. And then gradually he lowered that rate, because Time Warner was, as a cable company, was making more money because they make money per subscribers. More people watch Fox, more money goes to Time Warner. Time Warner made out okay. But here we have a case study of how our media is monopolized and controlled at the same time that the Obama administration is involved in trying to further deregulate the media environment and make it harder for other voices to be heard and to be seen.
That's correct. Yeah, that's a good point.
So, so this whole context is also missing. The one thing the media doesn't always do a very good job of reporting, even a worse job than the other things, is reporting on themselves and their own interests and how, they function and what have you.
Well, the Russia TV actually is filling a niche, as you just pointed out. Max Kaiser's on it. It has quite a few shows, Capital Report. You get a lot of critique there that you don't get on, that you'd think you'd get on MSNBC or...
It's very interesting, isn't it? The American left, maybe with the exception of Amy Goodman's, one show, has been unable to really crack into television and to mass media.
Even on her show, the beginning of her show, where she goes over the world news, I mean, that turns out to be the most interesting news that you don't get on the cable channels at all.
Right. Well, exactly. Well, my point is, here comes a network from Russia that knows something about packaging, mm-hmm. graphics, I hate to say it, pretty girls presenting news and information that are, an attractive package for an audience to watch, and they've built a significant audience.
Mm-hmm.
You have to give them credit for that. RT has done that. Other channels like Press TV, the Iranian channel, has been kicked off the air, both first in England and now in Spain, by the satellite providers at the direction, essentially, of the European Union politicians who are operating at the direction of the American politicians. So you have, a shrinking of perspectives when the officials have anything to do with it. But when people are allowed to actually create something interesting, and they have some resources to be competitive, they actually can build an audience. Mm-hmm. That's what to me is speaks to what are people interested in. Yes, people were not interested in current TV because it went through several different programming formulations, but their failure should not tell you that Al Jazeera will do the same thing. Al Jazeera has been extremely successful all over the world in providing news and information. So, here you have, we're judging, current TV doesn't have a big audience, therefore we're taking off Al Jazeera. Does that make any sense? Which hasn't really even developed or launched their service.
That's a good point.
So that's what we're dealing with here in the media frame. But what you're dealing with in economics, which is a little maybe, I don't know if it's more complicated, really, because what you boil it down to is some very basic things, like who benefits from certain decisions and who loses. I think that's a very basic set of questions to ask.
That's what you should always do with policy. And when you look at Obama's policy, you realize that it's always his campaign contributors, Wall Street and the real estate interests and the health industry.
You know, what's interesting is where is the calculations of who gave money and what they got for that money?
That's all pretty much, you can piece it together from the campaign contribution reports. You know that Wall Street is the largest contributor to the Democratic Party, as it is to the Republican Party. You know that in Congress, each Democrat has to pay the Democratic Party within Congress $1 million in order to become committee chairman. That's why Dennis Kucinich couldn't afford to be the committee chairman of his committee.
Is that right? I don't think most of us know that.
Yes. So they have to raise $1 million to give to the Democratic campaign committee. And that means that if someone is in the position of Dennis that represents the people, not the large campaign contributors, they can't afford to buy control of a committee chairmanship. And he was one of the most important committees in Congress, the Oversight and Investigations Committee. So that means that whoever has the most money is able to buy control of the committees, which is why if you're running on, all the congressmen want to be on the banking committee, because if they're on the banking committee, then they're going to get a lot of money from Wall Street to make sure that they're there representing Wall Street's interests and blocking anything that threatens their interest.
I'd like to give a little plug, and then I'd like you to do one as well. And, you know, I did a series, I don't know if you had a chance to see this, but I actually did a series called Who Rules America? Half-hour programs. Where was it shown? In Iran, of course.
I did miss it. I was not. I have to admit that.
Okay, but at any rate, it's available on YouTube.
Uh-huh.
Who Rules America? And I have some very interesting information. I think most people don't know about the role of the military-industrial complex, Wall Street, how politics has basically become a business, a little bit of the history of this in the United States going back to the American Revolution and the Shays Rebellion, fighting against the plutocrats and the people who use the revolution's success to their own advantage. These are all old stories, familiar stories, but you might want to just Google it on Who Rules America, and you'll see these segments will pop up, I believe. I'll go to Press TV, and they'll pop up there. Now, your website, which I was spending some time reading earlier, it's mh-.com?
No, it's michael-hudson.com.
michael-hudson.com.
If you Google Michael Hudson, it'll come right up for Economist, and you get the site.
So please, people, check out Michael Hudson's work and his books and his site. He's one of the real truth tellers in America. He's one of the people who really, you know, drills down to what's really going on or who's benefiting by it and how they've managed to take over, in a way, our government, our economy, and the like, and get you and I to think, you know, this is all being done in our interests to kind of whittle down the deficit or to, you know, lower taxes. But none of that is really happening. And most people don't know it because the media doesn't report it. But Michael Hudson offers an analysis that goes deeper. I write about your work in my blog at newsdissector.net. all the time. He's done some remarkable work about Greece and how this whole crisis evolved there and the like. So thanks so much, Michael. I know you have to run, but thank you for joining me today.
Thank you very much, Danny. It's always a pleasure.
And, you know, I can't say enough good things about you. Now we're going to go out in this segment with a tune from In Debt We Trust, the anthem.
To chase and to walk home via Wells Fargo, Sally Mae, to MasterCard and Citibank, and also B of A. American Express and Visa, Morgan Stanley, too. In debt
could listen to that all day, and you would listen to it if I played the whole thing. It would take all day. That's Fela. Fela Kuti, Nigeria's great Afrobeat star. There was just a Broadway show on about him, one of the great musicians from the Third World. And the song is called Zombie, and it was written basically as a protest against the police encircling his headquarters, which was called the Kalakuti Republic. And he put these big loudspeakers outside and blasted them with this song Zombie, basically calling on them to think for themselves and not act like zombies, in return for his effort to try to educate and raise their awareness. They raided his home, beat him up savagely, and imprisoned him. And he was really a musician that could have become the president of Nigeria. I wanted you to hear it because I was hoping to have a guest with me who's an African, who is a journalist writing about Africa, but clearly is not going to be able to make it. So we're going to move on and try to talk some more about some of the issues that Michael Hudson raised with us. I'd like to hear from you. You can call in at 888-874-4888. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector. You can listen on the phone at 832-280-0066. You can hear, you can join us on a toll-free number, 877-627-5065. We're talking about this so-called fiscal cliff and what actually happened in the last few days in America with, you know, first the Senate and the House buying into this deal crafted by Joe Biden and Obama, but supported by lots of CEOs and major interests in America. And what it was really about, we were told it was there to save the middle class. And I'm questioning that in a commentary I've written for Al Jazeera. You know, essentially, you know, it's long lived the middle class now that it has survived the fiscal cliff and has been saved. President Obama basking in the glory of the beaches in Hawaii after having averted the deepening of a crisis that is more structural than political and hardly resolved. Forget the working class. I mean, that term is passé, as is the so-called and usually undefined great mushy middle class, which moves into its rightful place as the center of everyone's concerns. Did you know that when asked what class you're in or aspire to be in, workers and even the poor say they're middle class in survey after survey, unless in that survey they also have the term working class. Then they'll select working class, but they usually don't hear it, and therefore they usually don't identify with it. Analysts who have looked closely at the big deal that was so hysterically pushed through Congress as the dramatic end piece of a year of political warfare say that there will be very little gain for the middle class, with income taxes down, but payroll taxes, FICA taxes up, ensuring that it will be more of a wash than any redistribution of wealth on any level. Economist Lambert Strether calls it the feckle cliff, noting cuts and tax increases, especially on the rich, are not commensurate. A sacrifice where some give up luxuries and others give up necessities is in no way shared. A marginal sacrifice for the rich is not commensurate with core sacrifices for the rest of us. This is an obvious point, but you'd have to search through all the Sturm und Drang in the media about the votes in Congress to find it. Our media prefers to look up at leaders on the national stage rather than down at the people who have to cope with their decisions. The headlines speak of a victory for the middle class, but the details show what an illusion that really is. There is an attack on the middle class underway that is not so-called breaking news. We can see it in all the measures designed to destroy unions and attacks on teachers. We can see it in limits on pensions and inflation that's making everyone poorer and everything pricier. With a new wave of big cuts still to come, it's not clear who will benefit, especially not that part of the middle class that relies on public education as the key to their upward mobility. In city after city, public education is in trouble, underfunded, trapped in bureaucratic warfare, with many public schools facing closure and others facing cutbacks. In Philadelphia, 17,000 students and more than 1,000 teachers are facing what's being called euphemistically a, quote, downsizing, with 37 public schools on the chopping block. Writes Bruce Dixon in the Black Agenda Report, quote, the fix has been in for a long time, and not just in Philadelphia. Philly's school problems are anything but unique. The city has a lot of poor and black children. Our ruling classes don't want to invest in educating these young people, preferring instead to track them into lifetimes of insecure, low-wage labor and or prison. Our elites don't need a populace educated in critical thinking. So low-cost holding tanks that deliver standardized lessons via computer if possible, operated by private, profit-making educational entrepreneurs, are now the way to go. Charter schools, they're called. These changes are always advanced in the name of better education and innovation, in the same way that the reforms, so-called reforms, that deregulated financial markets and led to its crash was labeled, you'll recall, modernization. In the Bronx, New York, the venerable DeWitt Clinton High School that for over 100 years educated several hundred thousand students, positioning many for the middle class, with many famous grads exercising leadership role in private industry, in media, in the arts, in public life, is now being threatened with closure as the neighborhoods that sent kids there and send kids there today become poorer and darker. And just for disclosure's sake, it was at that high school that I first learned about journalism on the school newspaper. Students, teachers, and alumni are up in arms at Clinton, fighting the threat with rallies at the school and petitions online. I've been working for months on a documentary to showcase the school, once the largest in America, and its century of achievement. You can see our trailer online at Vimeo.com. Just go to Vimeo and punch in DeWitt Clinton High School. Behind all of this is an unseen but fundamental shift in our economy, according to Michael Hudson, the economist we just spoke with. He writes, he says, today's economic warfare is not the kind waged a century ago between labor and industrial employers. Finance has moved to capture the economy at large, industry and mining, public infrastructure via privatization, and now even the educational system. At over $1 trillion, U.S. student loan debt has come to exceed credit card debt in 2012. The weapon in this financial warfare is no larger military force. The tactic is to load economies, governments, companies, and families with debt, siphon off their income as debt service, and then foreclose when debtors lack the means to pay. Indebting government gives creditors a lever to pry away land, public infrastructure, and other property in the public domain. Indebting companies, it enables creditors to seize employee pension plans. And indebting labor means that it's no longer necessary to hire strike breakers to attack union organizers and strikers. These are stealth trends. They float beneath the surface of public political debate, and they get lost in the miasma of partisan talking points and posturing politicians whose main goal seems to always be appearing to do something, but usually always in the service of the status quo. Debt is often profitable and will be fought over for years to come. This is a commentary that appeared on my blog, newsdissector.net. It's an attempt to analyze and explain what's really going on, to go a little deeper. And, you know, this is what we try to do here on Progressive Radio Network, is to try to go deeper, to offer perspectives that you don't hear elsewhere, and perhaps to get to that moment, you know, kind of that wow moment where you say to yourself, gee, I didn't know that. Is that right? This is not really about deficits. It's not really about tax cuts. It's not really about cutting the rich. It's about building a wealthier elite, you know, buttressing the 1%, not cutting it. So this is what, you know, I've been trying to do as a filmmaker, as a writer, as an author. My new book is called Blogathon, where I go into all of this in some detail. I've also written Occupy, Dissecting Occupy Wall Street, published by Cosimo Books. So if you're interested and you can hear my voice and you're interested in what I have to say, check it out. I'm very pleased this week that the Buffalo News, which is actually one of the highest circulation newspapers in America, the Buffalo News, did you know that? Carried, you know, a review of my books that have been ignored, basically, by the New York Times and so many other publications. We're very positive about them, and I was pleased to see that. You know, it's hard enough to get ideas into the mainstream and to avoid getting trapped in the lamestream media. But, you know, I come out of the mainstream media. I worked at ABC News. I worked at CNN. I worked at CNBC. I know something about media. I've written 15 books that touch on media issues. And so that's why I'm also doing this show, to try to bring these issues to a larger audience. I worked in radio at WBCN in Boston years and years ago. The station was bought by CBS, ultimately, which has recently closed it, which was a venerable institution in the New England area with a tremendous following, a tremendous loyalty because of the honesty and the creativity on the station. There's now a film being made about that by my buddy Bill Lichtenstein called The American Revolution. So that's something to check out when it does come out, because you'll see what people could do who were creative and were caring and concerned with a radio station that was at the top of, you know, really the center of the dial, the FM dial, and had a massive audience. Unfortunately, PRN doesn't have the same kind of massive audience yet, and Pacifica Radio is having a lot of frustrations and problems. But we can do something about it if we can help cross-promote what we're doing. And I call on you to do that. You can call me now at 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888, if you want to join me in this conversation. PRN FM also has an archive, so this program will be in the archives, will be on a podcast on iTunes, and you'll be able to not only check it out, but share it with others if you think it has some value to it. I'm trying as best I can to distill a lot of experience and analysis that I've been working on for a long time with an audience, and to talk about these issues. You know, the final topic I wanted to turn to, I raised with Michael earlier, but I couldn't go into detail then, and I'd like to do so now because of what's in the papers today, which is namely that Al Jazeera, the network based in Qatar in the Middle East, which emerged into a powerful news force during the before the Gulf War, which became an even bigger news force as a result of the Arab Spring, and which created an English language channel, Al Jazeera English, is now on the air in over 200 countries. It has a big website at aljazeera.com. It's very well known and very widely respected. It does talk shows, it does documentaries, etc., and so forth. And as a consequence, you know, it's a network that a lot of people are interested in seeing and finding out, comparing, contrasting with what we're getting. And it's been hard to do. It's an international network. It may be based in an Arab country, but at least on the English side, there are people there who work for BBC, work for CNN, worked in a lot of places. And I've been contributing to their website. Occasionally, I'm actually interviewed on air there. So, you know, it's a network that offers perspectives, diverse perspectives of the kind that we don't get in our own media. So, you know, the question I started posing today was, why does our media system attract so many uninformed and unbrave people who are locked into such parochial attitudes? Do they have an agenda for the public to be aware of? Take Time Warner. Remember how it initially would not run the then new red, white, and blue Fox News on its platform in New York, forcing that company to cough up a high per subscriber fee to get on the air? That was a clear commercial dispute with a bit of extortion thrown in, an attempt to protect CNN, which that company owns. Now that Al Jazeera has bought Current TV, a channel carried on Time Warner, the Time Warner megacorp, Time Warner Center here in New York, became the first cable operator out of the box to say it would not carry this new news channel that the Al Jazeera network wants to launch in America, in much the same way that BBC set up BBC America to offer its programming to U.S. viewers. Even as Time Warner carries Russia Today, CCTV out of China, and other foreign-owned channels, it is excluding this channel because they know it will what it will offer. This could be a ploy to jack up license fees, a la Fox News, but there's probably more to it. In reporting on the deal, Fox first focused on how much money, $100 million, it claims Al Gore, an early investor in Current, will make for his 20% stake in the network. Bashing Democrats is always Fox's first priority. Fox does not report on rumors that Fox owner Rupert Murdoch and his Saudi partner, Prince Waleed, visited Al Jazeera and reportedly were interested in buying the channel, nor that Al Jazeera frequently exposed bogus pro-U.S. military propaganda that Fox ran as news during the Iraq War. You'll recall that Al Jazeera reporters were killed by the U.S. military in Baghdad and Kabul, with one cameraman sent to Guantanamo on charges that were never proven. You may remember that George Bush joked about bombing Al Jazeera's headquarters in Doha, a threat that was idiotic since Qatar allowed the Pentagon to base our troops there and run the coalition media center there. A major supplier of natural gas to the U.S., Qatar has moved closer to the U.S. and was allied with Washington in its war on Libya and now on Syria. Al Jazeera seems to be covering both wars sympathetically now that its government is more involved in it. But Fox News has a habit of not letting facts get in the way of its coverage, reporting that many Americans, quote, feel it's a terrorist network, perhaps because Al Jazeera to them idiotically sounds like Al-Qaeda, and because this feeling is always being reinforced by bombastic pundits who are scoring political points, not making factual statements. Fox reports Al Jazeera has been criticized for having a pro-Islamicist bent and accused of working with members of Al-Qaeda. One of its journalists, they say, was arrested in Israel in 2011 on suspicion of being an agent of the Palestinian group Hamas, which is, by the way, not Al-Qaeda. His name, Samir Alawi. He was the Kabul bureau chief of Al Jazeera. He was later released, a fact that Fox ignores. The report goes on. Dave Marish, a former Nightline reporter who worked for Al Jazeera in Washington, said he left the network in 2008 in part because he sensed an anti-American bias there. As it turns out, I spoke with Marish, who I worked alongside at ABC News, about why he left. And he said it had more to do with his wanting to report with his wife from the field and not be stuck into an anchor chair. Last year, a publication called TV Newser reported that Marish still respects Al Jazeera, which is the opposite of what the Fox article insinuates. He's quoted as saying, "The product is too good, too significant to not have a market in the U.S., given the complete abdication of American networks and cable channels from actually covering international news. The current situation," Marish says, is tragic. It plays into the ignorance of American viewers, most of whom are clueless as to what the world thinks and why. It's very harmful, he says, to America's effectiveness and stature in the world. So besides Fox's smears and aversion to the truth, there is a question of what is behind the knee-jerk reaction by Time Warner. Can it have to do with the business Time Warner does with Israel, a country that incidentally allows reporters from Al Jazeera to work there, and then shows their reports? When it was owned by AOL, Time Warner was active in businesses in Israel. Jerusalem Post reported three U.S. companies that invest in Israel, AOL, Time Warner, IBM, and Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation, were lauded, that is to say praised, at the America-Israel Friendship League's Partners for Democracy Awards dinner. Hooray for them. So yes, Time Warner has been friendly to Israel, with top executives aligned with Israeli charities and fundraisers, with some correspondents accused of bias. CNN's Wolf Blitzer of the Situation Room once ran the Israeli lobby group AIPAC, but the charges that CNN has slanted the news is disputed and part of a larger debate about the pro-Israel orientation of almost all TV outlets. The question right now is, what is really happening here? What are they afraid of? And I think they fear that some fanatic pro-Israel group might target them for carrying the channel in New York, because their New York is so full of haters who will respond to this appeal. So this is one more battle over media diversity in a culture where media monopolies dominate and try to assure that the public is only being exposed to the official story, especially on international stories where being, quote, patriotically correct seems to be a top media priority. So that's my view. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector. I'd love to hear your view. Please follow me on Twitter at Dissector Events. Follow me at Facebook and in my blog at newsdissector.net. I'm there every single day. You can get the program that you're listening to in the archives from PRN.FM. And tomorrow, I hope I will get the URL, which I can share with you in my blog. So that's the program today. Danny Schechter, your news dissector, signing off. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being here. Please share the news of this program with others. See you next week.
The country, they built the middle class, unions and inventors, the teachers and the brass. But now it's run by players, a zero-sum game, buying politicians, and the unions get the blame. Which side are